This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. There's a bit of an unwitting theme on today's Woman's Hour. Sometimes that just happens here. Today I would describe it as firsts for women, ambition, leadership and politics. Today we will bring you a sobering update on local elections and the experiences of some female councillors in this country. Leaving these shores, we will share news and insights about the very first woman to become the Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, of the DRC. That's Judith Suminwa Tuluka. We'll be hearing about her and what we know of her. We're also going to hear from a young woman, Emily Worthmore, who states that her ambition is to become the President of the United States. Should she or any of her teen female cohorts on a mock government programme that's now the subject of a new Apple TV documentary achieve their stated dream, they too would be the first women to lead their country. But Emily also states that in addition to being president, she wants to be a rock star and a broadcast journalist. Well, I can get on board with the last one, but that she could, crucially, she believes she could do all three. So keeping with the idea of ambition and whatever yours might have been, what they still are, what you still dream of becoming, perhaps you're doing some of it now, or perhaps it is wildly different to what you thought you might do with your life, whether it was rock star, leader, I don't know, crafter, lawyer, doctor, creator of some description, whatever that might have been, or maybe it was to have children, whether it was more on the familial front, maybe it was to help your local community, whatever that looks like to you. Have you done it? Are you doing it? How has it changed from when you were at a different point in your life, perhaps when thinking about being Emily's stage and age? Emily, this programme that we're going to hear a bit more, this film, is 19 at the moment. What was it like when you were at that point? Have you done it? Are you doing it? How has it changed? You can text the programme here, 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour. You can email me through the Woman's Hour website or send a WhatsApp message or voice note on 03700 100444. So those are the numbers that you need. We're also on the programme going to be hearing from a debut novelist about husbands coming out of the attic. More of that very shortly, actually, or not, depending on how you view sliding doors moments in your life, which may also feed into our conversations about ambition. And there's some new information about the highly secretive female codebreakers at Bletchley Park during the war. So all that to come and more. Hoping to bring you some information on the local elections and some potential law changes around what information is disclosed. But I just mentioned husbands coming out of the attic. You may think, what are you on about, Emma? You may think that quite regularly if you listen to Woman's Hour and to our daily conversations with me. But I do have an answer, or maybe I do. Let's see what you think of this. Have you ever played the what if game? The what if you'd never met your best friend on that day that you did? What if you'd missed the bus to your job interview and ended up working somewhere else? What if you'd never met your other half? Those sliding door moments are a big part of the debut novel of Holly Gramazio, The Husbands. It tells the story of Lauren, who realises her attic is producing different versions of husbands each time a new one arrives. Her life changes a little bit too. Who to stay with, how to make that decision, all some of the games and thoughts going through the mind of the protagonist. Holly Gramazio, good morning.
Good morning.
An interesting take on how to think about sliding doors moments. How did it come about?
Well, I've always been very interested in this concept of different versions of your life quite nearby. The way that you could have caught this bus or gone to that party and everything might have been quite different. And I think the idea of having husbands coming out of the attic as a way to make that real for the plot of the book just came because I grew up in Australia and we don't really have attics there.
And now you live here and you decided to use it.
I moved here. Everyone has these rooms where they say, oh, I don't really know what's up there. I haven't gone up there in a year. Oh, maybe there's some chairs. Maybe there's a Christmas tree. Maybe there's grandma's old curtains. Not really sure.
I mean, just lurking there. I don't have one, but and you know, lots of people won't as well, but they'll definitely know people who do. It is definitely part of housing structure in this country for
lots
of people.
And I just encountered them as a kid in books where maybe they would be a magical attic that's a portal to another world in a book written in the UK or the US, or maybe in, you know, a gothic novel where perhaps a wife would be trapped in an attic.
But you are actually in the book saying different men come out of the attic, the husbands, in the way that I've described. But is it sort of a metaphor, really, of different ways your life could go? Because I'm just trying to think, if a man came on here and talked about wives, many, many wives coming out of the attic, it would sound perhaps not that great to our listeners in some ways.
Yeah, it's very much a metaphor for thinking about different ways that your lives might have gone, particularly different people that you might have ended up with, but also relationships you might have with your neighbours, what your friends would be like, what your job would be like. And it's also a little bit of metaphor for, you know, the swiping of online dating, this carousel of faces that you're meant to look at and decide whether you're interested and go, yes, no, yes, no.
You are interested in gaming, aren't you?
You've got
a bit of a background looking at that, and you've had good experiences, I believe, with like community online around that. Tell us how that's fed into that.
Oh, well, definitely my background in games fed into the novel a lot. I'm a game designer and a games writer for my job before I started writing a novel. And I think something that happens a lot when you're making a game is that you spend a lot of time thinking about what people are going to do in the course of that game, what choices they're going to make, what they want to try out. And that definitely fed into the structure of the novel, thinking about when people reading the book would be wanting the main character to be trying out different things, but also how might she make those choices in that situation.
So when you design a game, because I know you enjoy them in your personal sense, mm-hmm. but you've obviously got this professional link as well. Do you draw it out? How do you design that?
It really depends on the game. But for me, often where I start is with a moment or an emotion that I want people to have, or an interaction that I want to happen. I've designed sort of physical games for museums and festivals as well. And maybe the image of a huge bunch of balloons going down at the end of a street that you see and know that you have to rush to get there can be the idea that sparks the game, that kind of forms around that. What would the rules have to be? What would people have to be trying to do in order to bring them that moment of emotion or interaction?
Well, it's certainly a great premise, and it's fascinating to link that experience of designing games to how you generate a plot in a novel, and so some of those choices. Do you have a moment in your life where you think, if I'd done this, maybe this would have happened? Do you think about those sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few, but I would say for me, the most significant one is in my late teens when I went to a local secondhand bookshop in Adelaide. I was looking for a particular poetry book, looked in the poetry section, couldn't find it. But I ended up picking this misfiled book that was a collection of essays on maths and games. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I guess I'll buy that instead. Bought it, took it home, read it a couple of years later, and found this discussion of a game called Gnomic in it, where players vote to change the rules. And I thought, oh, that sounds neat. I would play that. Found an online community, a mailing list that were playing it. And I got to know people through that were the reason that I started designing games. So my current job, my husband, most of my friends, all of that leads back to this misfiled book in the O'Connell's Books in Adelaide in, you know, 1998.
Well, it's interesting because it links a bit to what I've been asking our listeners already, and we're getting some messages this morning about what did they have as their thought for their life, you know, their ambition, and where have they ended up and how have they got there? And I suppose what you're thinking about is those roads that perhaps you didn't take as well as the ones that you did and where that comes from. I'm not sure, I don't know, maybe people do think about this, if they trace it back or not. It's interesting to think what has led to that moment.
I think most people don't have something that's quite so starkly obvious as this one book in the wrong position is why I do what I do, why I know the people I know. But it might well be that there is something like that for them, but it's just harder to pinpoint, that you can't necessarily go, oh, it was that bus I didn't catch, in the same way that I can with the book.
Do you gamify options in your life? Do you think, I might do this or I might do that, but that might lead to this and I'm not sure I want to do that? And then people have paralysis around decision making a lot of the time anyway, but I wonder what it's like inside the mind of a games designer and now someone who's written a novel with some of those themes.
I am so terrible at making decisions, which is part of why I wrote this book, right? Right, to explore being bad at making decisions and what that feels like. So I do all sorts of things. I'm a big spreadsheet maker. I do lots of spreadsheets. And when
I can't do spreadsheets, don't like them, but can make decisions. So you do this to help make decisions.
I do. I'll go, well, where should I live? I'm going to make list 10 different cities, do all of the different criteria that I care about. Like, is work there? Are my friends there? What's the coffee like? All of this different stuff. And then I give them scores.
What's the attic game like?
Yeah. And then I'll be able to get a number that tells me where to live. But actually, because there are so many different things that I'm scoring, it's kind of a chance for my subconscious to worm in there and weight the things a little bit, right?
But you must drive yourself mad a bit at times if you're trying to really, I suppose, go through every element.
Oh, absolutely. It's a terrible idea. Awful way to make decisions. Do not recommend it.
Well, isn't there a school of thought, and I was reading about this only recently, that there's no such thing as wrong decisions. You've got to make the decisions you make right. And I think that's quite liberating, if you can get on board with that.
I think so. And the idea that if you're really torn between two decisions, that's probably because they're roughly equal in how good they are, right? When I was little, I was still very bad at making decisions. And occasionally my mum would take me to the ice cream shop for a special treat. And she has this story of the times that she would drag me out of the ice cream shop 10 minutes later in tears.
Oh, no.
Because I had been unable to decide whether I wanted raspberry or lemon. And so I ended up getting nothing just because I couldn't pick one of them. And they would both have been fine, right? It's not that important and it's not that difficult. So I definitely think there's something to be said for, if you're that torn by it, they're probably both roughly equally okay.
And it's going to be okay.
Yeah, you just have to pick one.
You have to take the plunge.
Then do what you can with it.
Holly, before our time together is over, and your novel is called The Husbands, there are many husbands or would-be husbands appearing in this woman's life, Lauren's life, your character's life. You mentioned a partner. Are they okay with the idea of many exes and men crawling out?
We don't have an attic, so yeah, he's fine with it.
a relief all round. You do need to get yourself an attic when you next make the spreadsheet, I think, after this book. Holly Gramancy, the book's called The Husbands. Thank you.
Thank you.
Messages coming in about ambitions, paths perhaps not travelled paths gone down. My daughter, age 6, asked if there was schools for bright children who love singing and music. She auditioned a year later, aged 8 3/4. She left home to fulfil her ambition to be a chorister, albeit 4 hours away from home. My goodness, she's on some amazing track there and seems to know her own mind better than perhaps any of us at the ages we're at. Yes, I've done it. Reads here this message. I've always wanted to have a career and a family. Didn't go entirely to plan. Ended up as a single mum, but I am established as a credible, educated, capable professional working to maximise people's potential within organisations. Current job title, European Culture Director. I think I've got that right here. In a global business, says Alex. Hattie says, I always wanted to be a writer. I was 19 in 1993, but the gatekeeping of traditional publishing meant I never even tried to get a book published. Nearly 30 years later, I am a successful independent author. and it is brilliant, but also sadly not something I could have done age 19, as the technology just wasn't there. My whole life from age 14 to age 23 was about getting into veterinary school. Work experience, exams, everything. That was great until I got to the third year of studying and realised I wasn't interested in science or medicine, and I've had to rethink. I've now been a primary school teacher for over a decade and reflect now that a veterinary career would have brought me none of the joy or social life that primary education does, says Sam, listening in Boston, Lincolnshire. Good morning to you. Fascinating. And what a thing to get to your third year and then have that realisation. You can think one thing and another thing comes along. Well, I'll be hearing a bit more about some of those stated ambitions of teen girls in America shortly. But let's stay here in the UK with politics and even closer to home in the form of local elections, soon to be upon some of us. If you live in England or Wales on May 2nd, you'll be able to vote in at least one election, as around 2,600 local council seats are being contested. But there are some downsides to putting yourself forward. It's been reported ministers are being urged to amend a law requiring councillors to publish their home addresses amid rising concerns about the scale of intimidation and abuse in local government and the impact it's having on women in particular. Ahead of elections to councils across England, the Local Government Association has argued that a 1972 law setting out that addresses are given by default is out of date and has left councillors feeling under threat. Some councillors have warned that a recent upsurge in abuse and threats, often fueled by social media, is forcing large numbers of women already in a minority in local government to quit as councillors, often after one term. Here's Talia Marrington speaking to The World Tonight about her experience. She's a Liberal Democrat councillor for Mousehole, Newlyn and St Berrian in Cornwall, but isn't standing in the upcoming local elections.
It seems to be so much worse post-pandemic, and people are so quick to blame and to judge. And I think as councillors, there's so little trust in politicians, in people in representative positions that we seem to be, we're more accessible, we're more visible, we do a lot of stuff that does affect people day to day, like planning and things like that, and we're less protected. And I think people are just so quick to judge, they're so quick to blame. Social media, of course, is there. In the old days, if you had a problem, you would probably write to the address of your councillor. But nowadays, it's Messenger, it's Facebook, it's WhatsApp, it's everything. You're sort of getting bombarded, and people are very quick to write things. There's no fact checking necessarily. There's things can stay up that are misinformation. And at the heart of it, we're disadvantaged. I didn't have my address for the elections, but then you could be from a huge area, so it doesn't look like you're local.
Talia Marrington speaking to The World Tonight. Listening to that, Jackie Weaver, of course, sheer viral lockdown fame from that Hanforth Parish Council Zoom meeting in 2021, where she was told she did not have the authority, in case you needed any reminding. But Jackie also local government sort of specialist, very passionate about it, and provides guidance and support and training to town and parish councils in Cheshire. Jackie, what do you make of this? And good morning. Good to have you back on the programme.
Thank you. And yes, good morning. I'm afraid it is something that we certainly hear all the time. This is specifically about addresses, but I noticed that your previous speaker was talking mainly, really, about online bullying and harassment. And that is absolutely rife at the moment.
And do you think that is something, because I know you're passionate about especially getting women involved with local politics and being councillors. Do you think that is a problem right now more than it's been before?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's something I've been talking about since lockdown. So much so that in Cheshire, we've been working closely with the police and the Police and Crime Commissioner, actually developing a protocol for how the police will manage meetings of parish councils when they get out of hand.
Really?
With members of the public that are so aggressive.
And in what sort of thing? Can you give us an example of the sort of thing that where it becomes difficult in that way? Because it is shocking that you might need the police.
Yeah. We try to be very transparent, and I'm sure that's true of the other tiers of local governments as well. So we always have a section at the beginning of meetings where the public can engage with the councillors, in the room. But they are so aggressive, like your previous contributor said. in terms of personally holding those counsellors to account for things that have nothing to do with them at all. I mean, it's not unusual, you know, for a parish council meeting, you know, for the members of the public to be vitriolic about potholes, which I know are, you know, kind of always a seasonal topic. But parish councils have nothing to do with potholes. It's not their responsibility. But that doesn't stop, you know, Mr. Angry or Mrs. Angry really, you know, giving forth and just totally disrupting the meeting. So, in effect, either the police are called or the meeting is closed.
Do you see equality in who's angry and most angry when it does turn in that way between men and women in the audience?
I think when it's face to face, it is more often men who are aggressive. And that might be, you know, my experience. I don't know if that's generally true. But online, it is often women.
Online?
Yes. Yeah.
That's interesting because, that, you know, it's trying to get a picture of who's doing what and how we are having these conversations about how our areas are run, our local areas, and what stake we have in them. Because we know, you know, women and men care deeply about their local area. But we also know just from work we've done on here before and a lot of the time, for instance, it's women who go litter picking and try and, you know, keep areas at least looking nice. And then there are different passion projects you can't usually divide by the sexes, but it's just interesting to get a sense from you about what you see around how people behave to each other and whether it's women or men and or both.
I would say my experience is that when it's face to face, it's men, and when it's online, it is often women. I think the other thing for me that's really interesting is that, you know, that those very angry, those people who want to criticise what our council is doing, never put themselves up for election. They would much rather sit online or sit in the audience and bitch from the sidelines.
You've got a big smile across your face as you say that. You know, a wry smile, I should say.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, it's all right complaining about, you know, your local my local council is a waste of space. Okay, well, how would you do it better? You know, come on and show us. And I think that, you know, the fact that we had elections in part of Cheshire last year, part of Cheshire this year, and actually we have more vacancies on councils than we've ever had before.
Really?
So, yeah, so it's not attracting as many people. And part of that, I think, comes down to conversations like we're having this morning, where if you're really trying to encourage different people to come forward to sit on councils, we have to be able to say to them, you are at least going to be in a safe environment. And frankly, at the moment, in some instances, we can't even say that.
What do you think are the solutions? You talked about having police at local meetings where necessary. What is there anything else that you and others have been thinking about who work in this space, care about this space?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's all about training. It's all about giving people who are councillors and who are perhaps chairing meetings the confidence to do it. I think we, in some instances, we're so afraid of being distant from the public or unaccountable that actually we take a lot of bad behaviour that should be stamped out really early, and it grows. So that if you tolerate bad behaviour from one person, then it's contagious. The next person thinks it's okay to behave like that, and you have now completely changed the tone of that meeting. So it's about calling out bad behaviour. I think all of us have a duty to do that. And stamping it out really early before it begins to really get hold.
That's how we got to know you, wasn't it? Trying to chair a meeting. I have to say, when we were thinking about this conversation this morning and your name came to mind in the office, we all were taken back to that moment in lockdown where we met you, Jackie. It's something that you were trying to deal with, I suppose, as you were being told you didn't have the authority.
The other thing is that, you know, as women, we kind of don't like, you know, sort of, let's say challenge, I mean, aggression, that kind of thing. You don't have to meet aggression with aggression. You can meet it with warmth and with humour and kind of, you know, head it off at the pass. So you don't have to change your own personality in order to stand up to poor behaviour.
Well, you've retained some authority and some, right?
In my mind, certainly.
No. In all of our minds, Jackie. It's good to hear you on one of your specialist subjects, though, and I know you care about it. And there's a challenge there for people to try and take it and take up their roles if they can in their local communities. But there's also a challenge for those facilitating it to, as you say, provide the training and make people feel, if they do take that step, that they will be looked after. Jackie Weaver, thank you very much for talking to us. Always good to have you on the programme. And I suppose if you're listening to this and you're thinking about my initial question to you about things you wanted to do, where you wanted to be, perhaps it does include politics, or at least not necessarily on a national level, but perhaps on your local council or closer to home. A message here from Paula says, I worked in HIV for 15 years and I left and then wanted to...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
To be a baker. I told my daughter I wanted to be like Little Miss Hedgehog out of the Sylvanians. So I ended up volunteering and now I have my own bakehouse in the countryside, and I may not have much money, but I'm very rich in life. So yes, I managed to change and do something completely different with no regrets. Paula, well done you. Thank you very much indeed for that. Well, let's go to then and hear a bit more about this documentary that's prompted this conversation about ambitions, certainly from when you were younger, and what you have become, what you wanted to become, where you are now. It's a documentary film that spotlights the girls hoping they will become the first female president of the United States. Since the office of the president was established in 1789, you will know no woman has held the position. The film's called Girls State, and it follows a real-life mock government program attended by teenage girls in Missouri. During the week-long residential, they elect their own leaders, including a governor at the very top of the tree, Supreme Court justices, and an attorney general. The American Legion, which runs the programs, holds separate programs for boys and girls in all states of the US. Previously, a film following the boys' program won several awards, and now the film following the girls launches on Apple TV later this week. Joining me now, the filmmaker Amanda McBain, who's behind both of those films on the boys and now the girls, and 19-year-old Emily Worthmore, one of the girls who stands for governor, which is the highest position in this mock government. A warm welcome to you both. Amanda, if I could start with you, tell us a bit more about Girls State. What is it trying to do? How does it work?
Morning. Hi. Girls State's a program that exists in every state in America. It has for 80 years. I grew up in California. I did not know about the program, but it's a robust program. It's gender segregated, always has been. But the core value, I think, behind the program was this idea of civil discourse. What happens if we gather a bunch of 17-year-olds, that's the age of the attendees, to come together and talk politics face to face, with the idea that people will have different politics, and what will happen when they do come together face to face and have these conversations. That was something that was very interesting to my husband, and I are co-directors. We started this project with Boys State back in 2017 after Trump's election, and recognizing how divided America was, and wondering what could happen in these spaces.
In the boys' space, was it very divided? Is that what you found at that age?
We shot that film in Texas, so a very conservative state. And what was so interesting is we followed a number of kids through the week, two of whom were fairly progressive. And to watch their trajectory and transformation through the week was sort of one of the great delights of nonfiction. And unexpected things happen. So there was more coming together than I think we had previously thought, and maybe to I think we thought there was going to be more of a Lord of the Flies situation than it actually ended up being.
And what about the girls then? You know, sort of a sibling film of this. How did it differ? In slightly different time, slightly different moments, and obviously looking at girls instead of boys.
That's right. It's a different time. It's 4 years on. And I think to some degree, our country's even more polarized. So we're also dealing with the emotional legacy of COVID. And there's a quality to gathering that was beautiful, actually. I think people were ready to come together. And I will also say, just Jesse and I have two teenage daughters, so I think there was something more personal in making this film.
Your partner in life and in work.
We co-direct and co-parent. So girls seemed to be looking for ways to connect, looking for ways to find common ground, and looking for ways to get things done. That's also partly how the boys program was set up, very much into two camps. It was sort of tribal warfare from the get-go. There was two parties that were built. And that dynamic was slower to get started at Girls State, for good and for bad. I think there was some frustration. Girls very much wanted to talk politics immediately. That's why they'd come to the session. But they had a number of days to get to know one another first.
Let me bring in someone who went on this particular, was part of this cohort. Emily, good morning. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you. And I've watched the film, and others will do now this week. Why did you want to go along to this program?
I had known about Girl State since my sophomore year of high school, because it's the summer after your junior year. And so my counselor knew I was into politics. They talked about it a lot. And she had told me, don't plan anything for this week of your junior year summer, because I have this program I think is perfect for you. And so I said, okay, I won't. And I looked into it. I had a lot more time to look into it too. I had known someone who went. And overall, it just seemed like a really good opportunity to get to start talking more politics and get to experience that little mock politics setting that was so exciting to me.
I did talk about your ambition at the start of our program, the idea of becoming the first woman to run the United States, a rock star and a broadcast journalist. And you say you could do all three. How are you doing with them?
I'm still on track for all three, I believe. I'm in a college band right now called Bethany Lane, and we play like indie music. So still play electric guitar.
Good.
And then I'm going to school for broadcast right now, and the election is 16 years away. So overall, we're on track for all three. So keep going there.
So you've scheduled when the election is for you, from your point of view?
Yes.
Why?
I've had that down since fourth grade. I think I looked at the first year possible to run. I'll be 36 in 2040, and the minimum age here is 35. So since fourth grade, I was like, I want to do it, and I want to do it young, because I also think that that really sets you apart from a lot of the candidates that we see now, being so old, all men, like front runners are mostly men. And I think that that would be a nice stand apart as well, just being young.
Okay. I like the fact, you know, straight in the first possible moment to throw your hat in the ring and go for it. You do throw your hat in the ring in Girls State. I mean, I don't want to ruin the film. You obviously know what happens, but it's pretty tough. You don't, you know, you also struggle with something a lot of people struggle with, is you're not sure how you feel about, and you tell me now how you feel about it now, public speaking. You know, it's not everybody's favorite thing, to say the least.
Yes. Public speaking was my biggest fear at Girls State, just because writing a speech and having a script, it feels really forced to me. I love doing interviews like this, and I love maybe panel discussions and things like that. And I think I've gotten a lot better and more confident in the past couple of years, but my body just gets so shaky whenever it's time to give a big speech. And so I think I had wound myself up so much around that. And that was definitely one of the most nerve-wracking parts of the week for me.
And yet you still want to go into a job that is largely, at times, defined by how you speak to millions and millions of people.
You know, I think that people who run for president get really amazing speechwriters to help them write really amazing speeches. And I think that if you ask me to talk to people and just like we're doing now, that's much easier. And I can definitely be personable and have a real conversation with people. Speech writing, I might need a little help with, but I think that, you know, I can grow a lot in 16 years as well.
Okay. All right. Well, it's good to get it out. I'll go back into Amanda in just a moment, but you also have to think, which is, you know, a part of, you know, being in politics or also just being in the world. You, in the film, it shows you thinking quite carefully about whether you will mention that you're a Christian and what your political views are. I suppose for the benefit of our audience, probably right of centre would be the way to describe it. And you do share, you do go there. How was that for you?
I think it was the first time that I had that opportunity to share in a setting where it felt comfortable to share, or not maybe not comfortable, but more acceptable. Since politics is something that I'd like talking about running for president and all this, but I didn't dig into the politics since it was something that we're almost conditioned not to talk about, since, you know, don't upset people at the dinner table with Thanksgiving or all that kind of thing. So I was really personally nervous to talk about it at school. I go to a mostly progressive high school at the time. And so I didn't want to upset my friends or anything like that. If anybody asked me, I would tell them, what's your opinion on this? I would tell them, but I wasn't going to be the one to bring it up necessarily. But Girl State was that turning point for me where I'm like, you know what? I'm going to be the one to bring it up. And a lot of these people I might not see again. So if they, you know, hate me because of it, that's one thing, I guess. But I didn't want people to hate me. I wanted them to listen, and I wanted to listen to them. And I think that mission was overall accomplished. So I'm happy with the way it worked out.
Amanda, you do see people coming together who have different views, girls coming together with different views in this. And I wonder, do you feel you saw some people, some women and young girls' political views change?
I'm not sure people's we did not see people's views change. It's a week long. What I'd say is that they achieve, there's exposure to people who are different from them. And that kind of humanizing of the other side seems to me sort of the recipe for a kind of change, right? For us, we're from San Francisco, California. Our political views are different than Emily's, but I think meeting her, finding all the ways that we are similar and talking about those ways that we're similar. We do a lot of talking about how different we are, and there's value to that. But I think at times we need to also remember some of the things we have in common. So Emily and I have common cause on representation of women and the halls of power in our government. We have common cause in how much we care for our country. We have common cause I think she's a great, she has a big heart. And I like to think I have a pretty good size heart too. So there are a lot of things that we share. And I think that's pretty important. I mean, just hearing Jackie Weaver talk about her experience, you know, that's the sort of thing that I think this program helps, even at the age of 17, just to have that exposure again to somebody. Some of these kids are coming from towns of 300. Some are coming from huge cities. They've never met each other before. To have that experience, even at that young age, when you're still kind of elastic, flexible, growing, seems to me that you're setting a path for understanding that you would carry forward with you into potentially a career in politics.
Well, Emily, I've also got to bring up the fact that you do a bit of journalism at the end of this, which is the end of this film, which is, it's really great to see that you dig into the funding structure of this program, that you look at how the girls' bit works according to its rules versus how the boys' bit works. Do you think, I mean, it's a long-running program, this, in the US. We've heard about some of the goals for it. Do you think that the boys and the girls state should come together? Because there would be some who argue it's not realistic to have girls doing politics on their own and boys doing politics on their own.
Yes. So I'm one of those people who does point out that it's not realistic to separate, you know, the genders like that, because that's not what we see today. So strategies that might work within that area might not work in society if we just, you know, focus on issues that are important to one of the two genders, you know, that might not go down so well in real politics. But I do think that there is a beauty to having these rinks and avenues for discussion. I think that it's tradition, so I like that idea. But I do like what Missouri Girl State and Boys State are moving towards, which they have this combined session where, you know, the boys and the girls sleep in different dorms, obviously, and they have their own assemblies and things like that a lot of times. But their schools of education are combined now, and I think that that's very good, because at least then you're taking a journalism class and there'll be male peers next to you. And I mean, why are we necessarily like segregating resources and things like that? I just think it's, you know, it was an interesting structure in the first place, but I'm glad that we're now moving towards more of that combined session. I think that for the sake of tradition and Girls and Boys State, it's kind of beautiful and it does help bond people really well. So I would keep them separate, but combine classes, combine assemblies, and have the opportunity for the same speakers and things like that throughout the day as well. Well, and I think that would open a lot of doors for funding as well.
You've got a lot to do, Emily. I don't want to keep you any longer, you know, becoming president, a rock star and a broadcast journalist. So you better crack on with that. Emily Worthmore, lovely to talk to you. Amanda McBain, congratulations on the documentary. Girls State is available on Apple TV Plus from the 5th of April. It's called Girls State. Just sometimes you tell me I haven't said the name clearly enough again at the end of our discussion. So there you go. But from girls who want to become the first female leader of their country to a woman who has done just that, Judith Suminwa Tuluka is to become the first female prime minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. She was appointed by the president and replaces Sama Lukonde, the previous prime minister, who's been in post since 2021 but resigned in February. Well, let's find out more about Prime Minister Tuluka, what her appointment could mean for women in the DRC. I'm joined now by BBC journalist Beverly Ochieng and Annie Modi, feminist activist and executive director of Afia Mama, an NGO set up to help women and children in the Central African country. Beverly, good morning. Let me come to you first. What do we know about the new prime minister?
Well, Judith Tuluka is an accomplished economist. And just before she was named prime minister earlier this week, she'd been the Minister of State for Planning in President Félix Tshisekedi's government for just over a year. Before this, she'd been in the banking sector. She worked in the UN with the development program. She did community projects in Eastern DR Congo, which has been the epicenter of activities by hundreds of rebel groups, which has led to one of the world's biggest mass displacement crises. And while she was in the Ministry of Budget, Tuluka did some work around establishing an emergency fund for low income and vulnerable households. It's off the back of this and all of this exposure and experience that she has been appointed in this position. DR Congo's security situation is quite precarious. And although there is some external support, there are UN peacekeepers who are preparing to leave at the end of this year. The Southern African community is deploying forces. The East African community did support them with forces. That needs to be supplemented by a strong government, a strong leader. And it's presumably why she was appointed to this position. And I suppose now her appointment is a milestone, because in 64 years of independence in DR Congo and more than 20 prime ministers, she is now the first woman in this position.
And do you think that will have an impact in the country? Do you think that will mean something? And do you think it will mean anything differently, perhaps for the women of the DRC?
I think it's a welcome change from what I've seen with some of the reactions, and it improves the visibility of women in a dominant government position. There's one website that said that Tuluka is a woman of exceptional, unwavering intelligence, some described as a fierce woman. There's a lot of focus on her academic and professional credentials and how that will complement DR Congo's development needs. There's a news that talked about how she needs to focus on the economy. In terms of the total population, I mean, women are only marginally more than men in DR Congo, about 50 million to about 49 million men. Tshisekedi has been described as a president who is a feminist. The current central bank governor is a woman. In the dissolved government, women at the helm were the helm of the mines ministry, which is the backbone of the economy, and the labor ministry. But the political scene is still largely dominated by men. There were much fewer women who were running in the election in December compared with men. Out of nearly 20 candidates, there were probably just one or two female contenders, if I remember right. And that says a lot about visibility. But the truth is, it's still quite quite a long mile towards that, because women's rights are sometimes not very well known in communities. People are still taken advantage of because they're not aware of their rights, whether it's maternal, freedom of speech, education, and even the accessibility to all of these services, given that a lot of the social disenfranchisement has arisen from those inequalities, from the conflict, and from systemic, long-term systemic issues around representation.
Let's bring in Annie at this point. Annie, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. What do you make of this appointment? And, you know, how do you think it may or not may not impact women's lives in the DRC?
Thank you very much. First thing, I'll join my voice with Beverly, what she was saying. For women and girls, this historical appointment of a woman for the first time as a prime minister, it means that there is acknowledgement of women's capacity to contribute in governance, to contribute in development, to contribute in peace building, conflict resolution, and you name it. It is extremely important because for the past 64 years, it was the glass ceiling was set that women were only going to be deputy prime minister. For the first time, it came only with this regime. Women, most of them are deputy ministers, deputy directors, not as head of institutions. So for the first time, this it will open up girls' ambitions. This will give them hope. This will motivate young women to not have to not limit themselves. And the next step, the next milestone will be to have the first female president for the Democratic Republic of Congo. Why not? This means a lot for women and girls at this point, because we've been fighting for years and years, for decades now, to just get that acknowledgement, because this was one of the reasons most women were not being appointed. The excuse was, we do not find women with capacity. Now having a woman as a prime minister is just taken that away. So
Please continue.
On the other hand, we have to acknowledge, I'm being very, very, very cautious on the challenges that are awaiting our first female prime minister, of the high expectations that is put upon her, while we know very well that as one person, she will not change much if not other changes occurs in the system itself. Because if the DRC has reached the point where it is, be it in security, economy, or other challenges, social situation, it's because we are being in a failing system. We're being in a country where corruption is taking over good governance. We are fighting for it, and now if expectation is extremely high, and then the judicial system does not work independently, and corruption is not being fought the way it has is supposed to be, and then security wise, the defense force it is not being led strategically, the expectation on her will not be reached, and at the end, all women will pay the price. Because as we have noticed, if one man fails, it is the failure of that man. But if one woman fails, it is the failure of all women. And it might take us the next 100 years, because it took us 64 to have the first female. If she did not respond to the expectations, the next waiting period might be even longer.
Annie Modi, thank you very much. Feminist activist, executive director of Afia Mama, which is an NGO set up to help women and children in the Democratic Republic of Congo, joined there by my colleague, the BBC journalist, Beverly Ochieng, reacting and hearing a bit more there about the first female prime minister of the DRC, Judith Suminwa Tuluka, which is fascinating to hear about. And talking about women in politics at all levels, coming back to this country, I have to say we've received a whole load of messages from women about the appointments to local councils ahead of the local elections, of course, but also around potential law change, imploring this law to change. ministers to change it around the publishing of councillors' addresses. Zoe said, I'm a female town councillor. I have zero abuse from the public. Other councillors, though, ... Councillor Liz has written in saying, I'm proud to be an elected member of a female majority parish council and a female majority district council. I truly hope it will bring more local girls into participating in local politics. Another one, I'm a local councillor. I fully agree with the wonderful Jackie Weaver. There are various times where I've grumbled about the vocal minority who love to complain from the sidelines. Incidentally, one of my male colleagues was left a threatening voicemail recently, which we think was connected to a recent litter pick. It appears that someone's drug stash was inadvertently collected and is now in the local tip. While we've laughed about it, there is nonetheless a safety issue. The matter's been reported to council bosses and the police. I'm a female town councillor. Let me just quickly share this one, another one, and I will not stand again due to the ostracisation and abuse from my fellow councillors, many of them female. Members of the public, meanwhile, mainly make contact to thank me. Now, just before our time is up, a code to break and a pattern to notice. How did 77 women from the same Cambridge college end up working at Bletchley Park during the war? My next guest, Dr. Sally Waugh, has uncovered a previously unknown contingent of female code breakers and other staff who were recruited to conduct top secret work as undergraduates. Sally, tell us more. You went to Newnham College, which is female only yourself. And you started this research. Tell us what prompted it.
It was an entirely accidental conversation. I was having coffee after lunch and a colleague said, did you know a code breaker? As it happened, I did. I had moved home in the late 1980s. And when I joined the new community, somebody said, oh, you need to meet Jane. And it turned out the aforesaid Jane was a lady called Jane Monroe, born Jane Reynolds. She went to Newnham in the mid-1930s. She read maths and she became a code breaker by invitation of a man called Stuart Milner Barry. And we didn't know anything about Jane's background until the said Stuart Milner Barry published an essay in the 1990s. 1993, it came out in a book of a series of essays. And Stuart Milner Barry helped to set up Hut 6 at Bletchley Park. And Hut 6 was where Enigma code from the Army and the Air Force came in to be broken. And alongside Jane, Stuart mentioned three other women. And I was intrigued because if Jane was there, were the other three women there? So I settled on it for a little while and then went to the archivist at the college, who is the one who's in charge of helping people find records, Frieda Midgley, and I said, can you help? Where do I start? So I looked into it and, funnily enough, all three of the other women were at Newnham. They could have been at Girton. They weren't. They were at Newnham. So this was intriguing. So I looked a bit harder. And in the records, there was a giveaway. Temporary clerk, Foreign Office. So I had a further look and eventually I got to about 20 temporary clerks, Foreign Office. And I had connections with Bletchley Park. So I went over, looked them up in the records. They have a roll of honour. And those ladies were known, but not all of them were known to be at Newnham. So we got in touch and augmented the records. And we went on. We got to 30. We got to 40. Here is the story. And so at this point, I dug out all sorts of other women. Women who had invented chaff in the war. A lady called Joan Curran was famous for inventing ships in the Channel prior to D-Day. But I was intrigued most about Bletchley Park. So I needed a historian. I needed context. And I needed to know a bit more about the college. So I asked Jill Sutherland, who is a historian of some repute, and also knew a lot about Newnham. And we unearthed a story. We got to 77, as you said. And we got to three important ladies. One of them was the sister of the said Stuart Milner Barry. She had been a vice principal, but we also had connections with Oliver Strachey. Oliver Strachey was a career code breaker. The Strachey's were a big family. Everybody probably has heard of the more famous brother, who was Lytton of the Bloomsbury fame.
Yes, indeed.
But also we had Pernell Strachey, who was sister. And it just happened that Olive's sister was also principal at Newnham at the outbreak of war.
Ah, so there was a link there.
There was a link. So we had two women. But we had a second link with Oliver. This made us all smile because Oliver had married a woman called Ray Costello, who had been in the suffragist movement in the early part of the century and had then gone on to found a Women's Employment Bureau. And so we had three women who could be described as powerful in the sense that they could determine the futures of other women. And they had employed this to very good effect. They had managed to quietly recruit a large number of Newnham women, and they just made their way from Newnham to Bletchley, just what the war required. We didn't need to know it was happening. In fact, the first thing they did when they got there was sign the Official Secrets Act. So the fact that we had a very nice, quiet recruitment method was ideal.
And did this, just in terms of with our time slightly coming towards an end, is do we know what happened, or are we able to say if their careers and their contribution to the war, did that then lead to, different ambitions perhaps and different lives for those women?
For some of them, yes, it did. One example would be Fiona Ead, who had started code breaking in the First World War and worked in Berkeley Street in one of the operations to start with, then went into teaching, became a school inspector because that's what was expected, and then was one of the first women to be recruited back on an emergency list. And she eventually made a career out of that, although she'd had the interruption to go back and be what women were supposed to be, shall we say.
Yeah, and a lot of them obviously couldn't actually ever tell anyone what they had done. So a sort of gap on the CV, as it were. It wasn't quite the LinkedIn days where you listed everything you'd done anyway. But I imagine quite a difference between the men, who still obviously had signed an Official Secrets Act, but it wasn't the same for the women.
No, it wasn't. Society expected that the women would subside basically back into obscurity. So men would come out, couldn't say a lot about what they'd done, but would have jobs. They expected a career. Women were not expected by society to have one.
And it must have been a terrible burden in many ways to keep the secrets and just find a way to explain what they had been doing during the war.
Yes, they couldn't say what they did, so they couldn't argue for a job. Yet they carried, some of them, the guilt of knowing that things like the bombing of Coventry were going to happen and not being able to prevent it because they couldn't give away that the code had been broken. And they married. They promised in those days in church to share everything they had, and yet they knew they were not going to share part of their life.
Dr. Sally Wolfe, fascinating to hear about 77 women from the same Cambridge College ending up working together at Bletchley Park during the war. We'll put some details on the Women's Hour website, as I believe there'll be an exhibition later in the year. That's all for today's Women's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Hi, this is Kirsty Young. I just wanted to let you know that Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, is back.
I'm telescoping two bits of the story together.
That's okay. It's only memory.
It's only show bits. We can say what we like.
In Young Again, we're joined by some of the world's most intriguing people.
Bill was the CEO at Microsoft at the time.
And I ask a simple question. If you knew then what you know now, what would you tell yourself?
Be very, very careful about the people you surround yourself with.
I gave too much power to people who didn't deserve it.
Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Sounds. I'm looking forward to your company.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.